Good evening, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. This is Sports Takeover on RMU Radio. Matt and Chris with you on your Wednesday night. Ready to get to it. We're going to start with a segment we like to call First and Short. Chris, why don't you lead us off?
All right. Our First and Short edition tonight will be primarily focused in the National Hockey League. Going to start with the Pittsburgh Penguins. Evgeny Malkin just set a big record in the NHL, 88th player in NHL history to reach 1,000 points. More importantly, though, fifth Russian ever to reach 1,000 points. Great for Malkin. It's unfortunate he was not in the top 100 list back when NHL made that list. But we'll move on from that. 1,000 points is good for Malkin. And Matt, we got another Russian doing good things, too. What's that?
Alex Ovechkin set a personal record for himself, 1,200 points in his career. He's the 49th NHLer to hit that milestone. He's added a few points since, but he hit the 1,200 mark in 1,071 career games, so over a point per game for him. One of the best pure goal scorers in NHL history, easily the best of this generation. Impressive number there to go with that impressive number of Evgeny Malkin. For Carey Price, goaltender for the Montreal Canadiens, he set the franchise win record as a goaltender with 315, passes Jacques Plante with a 3-1 victory over the Detroit Red Wings the other night. Brings his career to 315, 221, and 67 in his 12 seasons. As of setting that record, he's played a few games since, but congratulations to Carey Price in Montreal.
Yeah, another funny thing, he actually is already the franchise loss leader, you know, with those 222, like you said, but it certainly is nice of him to get the win lead. When you play so many years, of course, you're going to end up with both. Tampa Bay Lightning, they are just doing everything right. They have already clinched the President's Trophy only 73 games into the season with 116 points. That means for the last nine games of the season, they could literally forfeit every game and still have home ice advantage throughout the entirety of the playoffs. It's the second fastest pace ever to reach President's Trophy. The Red Wings back in 95-96 did it in 71 games. So Tampa Bay, they got the right formula for success, and one player on their team is setting records for them as well, right?
That's right. Steven Stamkos now has more goals with the Tampa Bay Lightning than any other player in team history. 384 is his total, passes longtime captain Vincent LeCavalier. Congratulations to Steven Stamkos. Talked about Ovechkin as one of the best pure goal scorers. Steven Stamkos is one of the ones right behind him. Terrific career for him and terrific story there with the Tampa Bay Lightning. And finally, we have some rookies setting records. Elias Pettersson now has 61 points on the season with the Vancouver Canucks in the 62 games he has played. That is the most by any rookie in the history of the Vancouver Canucks with 61 points. Rasmus Dahlin in Buffalo has racked up 38 points in his 72 games. That is the fourth most all-time for rookie defensemen. So two very impressive rookie campaigns right now in the NHL.
Yeah, and Dahlin is only 4 points behind second place all-time. I'd imagine with about 10 games left in the season, he's probably going to try to get them 4 points. His head coach, Phil Housley, is about 30 ahead of the pace, so I don't think anybody's going to be touching that. But still, rookie's doing some good things. Pettersson, he's kind of been talked about as the Calder candidate. Jordan Binnington's come up recently, but certainly setting a Canucks rookie record for points will certainly get the job done. So that was First and Short for the NHL. Time to get into the meat of the show, Matt, and where are we first going to start?
Major League Baseball. It feels like we were just talking about Major League Baseball in the show not that long ago, and yeah, it's already back.
Already.
So let's start with a season preview and kind of see what kind of teams are making moves, what direction we're going in, some headlines of players. Chris, go ahead.
All right, so I'm going to start with player extensions. A few have happened really in the last week. It's like they've been waiting all offseason for Harper and Machado to sign, for everybody else to sign the extensions. Starting with the Los Angeles Angels, Mike Trout signed a 12-year, $430 million extension. That's about $35.8 million a year annual average value. All $430 of that is guaranteed. A fun fact about that is valued at higher than 8 NHL franchises' current value. So Mike Trout is worth more than 8 NHL franchises. Matt, thoughts on this monstrous contract?
So normally, I defend big contracts like this because
you love the long deals.
Yeah, because in my opinion, you get paid what you're worth. And these guys can do things that no one else on the planet can do. And that's why they get paid to do this. Teams value them at this. Fans value them at this value. And the money that the league brings in has to go somewhere, and I like seeing it go to the players, but this for me is too much. The fact that it's all guaranteed is awful. The fact that $430 million is just a ridiculous amount of money, and for the LA Angels, like, if we put aside how much money this is for one individual person, for this team, they haven't been able to put a good, successful team around Mike Trout at any point in his career. I find it hard to believe that now that this much money is tied up in one player, they're going to be able to do it. think that this is good for them. I mean, congratulations, you have the best player in baseball for the time being, but I don't see you being able to put anyone around him. And this isn't a sport where one guy can win you a World Series. They can't win you a chance. It's not basketball where LeBron can carry you on his back to a championship. Mike Trout's not going to be able to do that for you. And if something goes wrong, God forbid, a career-ending injury for him this year, what happens to the rest of that money? It's going to him anyway, and you're getting absolutely nothing for it. I think it's way too much. Good for them for keeping him, but at what price?
Yeah, in all of Mike Trout's history with the Angels, one postseason appearance, zero wins. So clearly the Angels have not been able to build around him. They've tried to. I mean, they've gotten different veterans in different years. They gave Albert Pujols that big deal whenever his contract expired with St. Louis. He's doing well, but, you know, it's not the Albert Pujols in St. Louis that was, you know, thought to set a home run record or something. They've gotten Justin Upton. He's okay, not great. I mean, it's just they have pieces, but it's never the right combination of pieces to get the job done. Pitching has always been subpar for them. And then it's almost seemed like the AL West where they compete has been controlled by different teams, just never them. The Rangers, earlier part of this decade when Trout was a rookie, made back-to-back World Series, did not win any. The Athletics won the division a few times in a row, and most recently the Astros have had a resurgence, and at no point have the Angels been the focal point ever in that division. Mariners haven't either, but we're not talking about any ridiculous Mariners contracts. We're focused on the Angels. So, I mean, Mike Trout obviously deserves every penny that he will earn. He is by far the best player in Major League Baseball. It's almost like that the Angels saw the deals that Trout and Machado got and said, okay, we have to get in here on our guy before, you know, someone else sweeps him up in the wild free agency market. He's going to be 39 when the contract expires. That's so far in the future. I hope he continues his pace. I mean, if he does, he could go down as one of the top five best players all time. I mean, some people probably consider him top 10 already, but it's a very big trust they're putting into Mike Trout, and I just really hope he delivers.
Yeah, and I mean, the $300-some million that Machado and Harper were able to get, that's one thing. When you're in free agency and there's teams bidding, I mean, you would think at least bidding for these players, but this is $100 million more than Harper made. It just seems unreasonable to me. I don't know why you couldn't have started lower, and maybe they did. We don't know how the negotiation went, but surely this isn't where they started. If it is, I don't know what they're thinking. I just think it's too much for one player. I don't know how your team is going to be successful moving forward. And, you know, even for the fans, you get to watch Mike Trout, but I don't know that you're going to get to watch much of anything else.
Yeah, that's a good point you make about the bidding. And when you see the free agency, obviously teams will give their offers or whatever, and the agent will work with the player to find which team gave the best offer. Well, when you're offering extension, the only person you're bidding against is yourself. You're saying, okay, you know, here's $400 million. Well, no, I want $400. All right, here's $410. You know, I don't know where they started. I can't imagine they started at $430, but I'd imagine somewhere around $400 million. I mean,
which is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's so much money. It's so much money. And he puts the fans in the seats. I'm excited to see what him and Ohtani can do in the years coming forward. I think the two of them will at least help get people there. It's just, I don't know. I'm glad he gets the money. You know, he's a great guy. He's very humble, very quiet, best player in MLB. But it's very interesting. Some other guys making not quite nearly as much money, but still good money, though. Going to the Houston Astros, Alex Bregman, my second favorite player in the league, behind Mike Trout, actually. He just signed an extension for 5 years, $100 million. That is an average annual value of $20 million. That's bigger than the second biggest contract in Astros history behind Jose Altuve's. What are your thoughts on this, Matt?
This one I'm fine with. It's not the amount of money that Mike Trout's making. And for the Astros, this is a competitive team. This is a guy that's worth paying money to because you are looking to compete this year. And in my opinion, and we'll talk about it more as we go through the season preview, the Astros are one of three teams that I think can actually compete in the American League. Obviously, the Angels are not one of those three teams. But to give this kind of money to a guy who's going to help you potentially win another championship moving forward, I think it's good, much better than the Trout deal comparatively.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're not as big a fan as the Trout deal, because we did that whole segment a few weeks back on, you know, how MLB contracts aren't as long as they are anymore, and it seems like teams have heard that and started giving out 10-year deals left and right.
We'll see, but like I don't agree with the top free agents receiving 4-year deals.
Right.
I also don't think it's in the team's best interest to give a guy $30 million for the next 12 years until he's 39 years old. To me, that just seems like sabotage down the road. I think, you know, 10 years from now, we're going to be looking back at these contracts, and boy, I'm glad that my team didn't sign into that deal. Like, I just don't think it's going to. It could pan out for them in the short term, but in the long term, I think it's too much. Somewhere in the 7 range maybe is better, enough to keep them throughout their prime and slightly beyond, but without, you know, totally committing your entire franchise to one player for the rest of their career. I just think it's too much.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I'm more of a fan of 8 years, I think, is a very good number. Some guys that are younger can go up to 10. Like right now, Alex Bregman, he's 24, so he'll be 30 when his contract's over.
That's good. That's right. Perfect.
Essentially, the prime of his career. 30, you know, is kind of whenever you turn, like, that middle peak for most people. Last season, he was an all-star, finished 5th in MVP voting, led the AL in doubles, 31 home runs. He is the guy the Astros are building around. Altuve was that guy when they were horrible. Now they have acquired so many prospects, good draft picks over the years, made the right signings. The Astros are here to compete now, and obviously with Bregman for the next 5 years, getting him at $20 million I think is a steal too, because this guy, if he can continue to put up the numbers he put up last year moving forward, he's usually a guy that's worth $25, $30 million a year. I mean, we saw the extension that Nolan Arenado received with Colorado. You would imagine that Alex Bregman is, you know, on the same tier as him, or even Manny Machado, both of them earning ludicrous amounts of money. So getting him for $20 for the next 5 years is good. If you happen to lose him in free agency, that's one thing, but I think the Astros put themselves in a position for these next 5 years to win immediately. I imagine Carlos Correa can probably see a contract similar to that in the near future, too. Two more contracts, one that did happen today, one that hasn't happened. I'm going to start with the one that didn't happen. Mookie Betts, he turned down an 8-year, $200 million contract following the 2017 season. That was before his MVP season last year. That would put him at $25 million a year. Right now, he's making, I believe it's $20 million on arbitration. He will become a free agent next season. Thoughts on him turning down the $25 million a year contract last offseason?
I think at the time it could be questionable, but looking at it now, it's the right decision. All he did was go out and win MVP while other guys were making $300 and $400 million. Mookie Betts is extremely smart for turning that down. He bet on himself. That was the right move. And I think it'll result in a bigger payday for him eventually.
Are you trying to make a pun there that Mookie Betts bet on himself?
No, but I'm glad that you picked that out accidentally.
No, but I do agree. It was very good for Betts to believe in himself, because if you look at his year-by-year breakdown, he gets better every single year. I mean, he's a young guy. He's obviously, you know, had a 10.9 WAR last year. That was highest in the league. Won MVP. Did everything right. He's a Gold Glove right fielder. Threw him at second base occasionally, because why not? He can do that too. I mean, he is one of the best top five players in the league. Turning down $25 million, definitely questionable at that time. That 8-year range, that's my range, but he's making the right decision. I think next offseason we're going to see him make at least $30 million on free agency, whether that's with the Red Sox or whomever decides to sign him. He will make more money than that, so smart of him. Questionable at the time, but the fact is coming out a year later, we can look back and say, you're a smart man, Mookie Betts. Chicago White Sox, last team here, doing interesting signing. Don't know how smart they are. So Eloy Jimenez, he is the number 3 overall prospect. He is a left fielder for the White Sox. Has not had a single at-bat in the major league level. Well, he just signed a 6-year, $43 million contract today with club options for 8 years, $77.5 million. So he is guaranteed to make $7 million for your next 6 seasons without having a single at-bat yet. He will be a good player. He is the number 3 prospect for a reason. He tore it up last year in AAA. He hit like .350 over the course of the whole season. He's a slugger. But this is a lot of money to give to a guy that hasn't had a major league at-bat yet.
Yeah, I don't like it at all. I think it's an awfully big risk to take when you've never seen him play in the big leagues. The one thing for the White Sox is that they're in no position to compete. So if this thing goes totally downhill for them, well, that's where they were going to end up anyway. So I suppose there's very low risk for the White Sox, but I don't know. I still don't like that much money going to someone who hasn't proven himself.
Yeah, and I mean, he has no at-bats yet, but you figure that they're getting locked up through arbitration. We've seen guys like Mookie Betts making $20 million a season this year to arbitration. Obviously, Jimenez will not have to worry about arbitration. He has a 6-year deal. The previous biggest rookie contract, Scott Kingery, had a 6-year, $24 million deal. So that's, you know, $4 million a year, which, I mean, it's a lot for some guys, but in the general scheme of MLB contracts, not really that much money. So, yes, this guy will be good, but the White Sox have the money to spend. I mean, who else do they have on their team, Matt? Can you think of, like, anybody else reasonable that can get their team any sustained success?
No, that's why I'm saying they're going to end up bad anyway. So the worst-case scenario for them is they waste all this money on a guy who never turns out to be what he's supposed to be, and they pretty much end up in the same place anyway.
Or the best-case scenario, 5 years, they're paying their MVP $7 million to lead their team through the postseason. time will tell on him.
Time will tell.
But right now, it's very interesting. Now to get into the season preview, what are we looking at in each of the divisions? We'll start in the American League, and I'll throw it to you, Matt. Go ahead.
So I think two of these divisions are pretty much sealed before the season even starts due to lack of competition. The Astros, I think, have the West pretty much on lock. We've talked about them and the success that they've had. World Series champions just a couple years ago. I don't see any team competing with them for that division. I think they're still as good a team as they have been in recent years. Going to the Central, I think the Cleveland Indians have that one on lock. Again, I don't totally love the Indians, but I don't like anybody in that division that isn't the Indians. And maybe someone could come out of nowhere. Maybe I'm missing something, but to me, the Indians are the team that will take that division. Not with the same success that the Astros will take the West, but for me, those two are fairly easy.
Yeah, I agree with them too. Houston last year finished 6 games ahead of Oakland. Oakland, I think, was a fluke. I don't see their team having as much success.
I agree.
Can they, you know, go above 500? Sure. Will they get 97 wins? Highly doubt it. Astros had 103 wins. I mean, that's just insane. Nobody else in that division is going to compete. Seattle traded half their team away because I don't know why. Just because why not? They want to get Ichiro back. And you said the Central. It's Cleveland's not great, but there's nobody better. I mean, last year Minnesota finished second and they had 78 wins. So when there's nobody else in that division that can compete with you, you pretty much have it locked down. I mean, Kansas City had 58 wins, Chicago 62, Detroit 64. How many of those losses were against the Indians? I don't have that number on hand, but I can assume it's quite a few. The Indians have good pitching. They have good hitting. But when you look at other teams in the West, it's just, or the AL, it's just hard for them to match up. The one division we haven't talked about, though, which I think is really wide open, is the AL East. What are your thoughts about the AL East, Matt?
I wouldn't say it's wide open. I think it's a two-team race. In my opinion, it's the Red Sox and the Yankees. I know you'll argue for the Rays, but I don't think that the Rays are on the same level as the Red Sox and the Yankees. I do think the Red Sox are trending downward a bit, simply because how do you keep pace with what you did last year? Mookie Betts was one of the best players in baseball. The Red Sox were the best team in baseball, put the best product on the field that they ever have in their franchise's history. Went into the luxury tax to make that possible. So I think for the Red Sox, it's just going to be difficult to sustain what they did last year. I like the Yankees personally. I liked them last year. I don't know that they will drop off. Not that I think the Red Sox will drop off, but I think the Red Sox will take a step back just because of how good they were. I think the Yankees will be right around where they were last year, and I think that'll be enough to take the division.
Yeah, last year Red Sox had 108 wins, like you said, best in their franchise history. Yankees, they had a 100-win season. Unfortunately, when you're in the same division as the World Series champion Red Sox, it's hard for them to compete. However, this offseason, they pretty much took a list, look at all the free agents, threw them in a hat, and picked out a handful of them because they just signed pitcher after pitcher after pitcher. Lost David Robertson. That's okay. They'll just sign Adam Ottavino. They'll sign Zach Britton. Recently, they just signed Gio Gonzalez. These are very good players. They already had the hitting there. The pitching was, I guess you could say, questionable, but it really wasn't that much. They did trade Sonny Gray to the Reds, which he did not have the success with the Yankees that he did with Oakland. Once again, I think it's the whole fluky nature that Oakland provides players for whatever reason is. I don't know what it is, but they took a gamble on Gray. It didn't pan out. Luis Severino, though, if he can compete the same level as he did the first half of last season throughout the entirety of this year, he can be a Cy Young candidate. It's tough for the Red Sox to do as well as it did last year. The Rays, though, they were right there last year. 90 wins, just when you're in the AL with everybody getting so many wins, especially that division, it's hard to compete. But they did have some good additions this offseason. They acquired Charlie Morton via free agency. They have reigning Cy Young champion Blake Snell, who, unless it's another fluke season, I think Snell is the real deal. I think, you know, he can go out there and give you, you know, maybe 18, 20 wins on the season. Probably not 24 like he did last, but still, 20 wins from a pitcher is very good. I personally like the Yankees as well. I don't think that the Red Sox will be able to keep up. I think Betts and Martinez had excellent seasons, but for them to do that 2 years in a row, that's just too insane for me to believe that.
And you figure for the Yankees, Gary Sanchez disappeared last year. Maybe
that's true.
Maybe that's who Gary Sanchez is, but if it's not, he only has to go up this year. He can't go much farther down than he was last year. So that's the Yankees getting better right there without even adding somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. And at shortstop, Didi Gregorius had rotator cuff, or Tommy John it was. He's out for half the season. That's okay. That'll sign Troy Tulowitzki, former Rockies great at shortstop. I mean, whenever they lose someone, it's almost like they take one step backwards and two steps forwards with these guys. It's just, they just have so much money to sign whoever they want. Oh, let's not forget, they did make that big trade for Stanton, too. So The AL East will be very fun to look at. Definitely some competition there. My two wild cards are going to come from the East. I have the Red Sox as the first wild card, right below the Yankees, and I have the Rays below them, just simply because nobody else in the American League is good.
Yeah, I'm on the same page. I think the Red Sox are easily probably better than the Indians, but they can't finish higher than the Indians, right, of course. And I guess, it's probably got to be Tampa. I don't know who else is there to compete. I don't think the AL is that strong. I think it's a three-team race, and I think it'll be that way throughout the course of the season.
So while we seem to have a fixed picture of the American League, the National League, I feel, is much more open in all of the divisions. I'm going to start in the National League East. This is a team we've talked about a lot this offseason. It's the Philadelphia Phillies. They've made all the right moves, capped off with the big Bryce Harper signing. They were a team last year that was, okay, we're getting to where we need to be, but we're not there yet. I think these moves have put them in the position to get where they need to be and be able to do better than everyone else. You see, Washington, they lost Harper, which was their big guy. They've never really had good success. Yes, they've won divisions, but they've just never gotten anywhere. They haven't won a division series. You look at the Marlins, they're horrid. They might be the worst team in the league. They are the laughingstock of the league. Derek Jeter has thrown this team in the fish tank, you could say. It's just all bad there. The Mets are a very interesting team. They have made a lot of moves. What are your thoughts on their moves, Matt? I can't really think about it right now.
I don't know that it's anything. I mean, they've been overshadowed by the Phillies in their division for sure, obviously with the Harper addition. To me, the Phillies were closer to contention last year than the Mets were. Nothing from the Mets stands out to me, and I don't know. Maybe someone will come out of nowhere, someone that I'm not expecting. For me, though, it's the Phillies division to lose. I don't think anyone's going to be overly competitive with the Phillies. Maybe the Mets make a move, but I don't think the Mets are where they need to be to keep pace with Philadelphia.
I think we're both knocking on Atlanta, too. They did win the division last year, but I don't know what your thoughts are on them. My thoughts are that they had a lot of rookies last year doing a lot of good things. Some no-names maybe doing a lot better. Mike Foltynewicz, he was top 10 Cy Young voting. He's not a guy that anybody thinks of as one of the best pitchers in the league. However, last year had a good season. Ronald Acuna and Ozzie Albies, excellent rookie campaigns. I just don't know that they can sustain this. It's very hard for rookies to have a bounce back here. Sophomore slump, we've heard of Cody Bellinger and Aaron Judge. Still good players, not as phenomenal as they were in their rookie campaigns. On a team that's so young, it's just hard for me to see the Braves being able to compete with these teams that now have the veteran presence on them to get them to the postseason.
Yeah, baseball is kind of a weird sport where it seems like every year a team or two comes out of nowhere, surprises you, makes the playoffs, is in playoff contention, whatever the case may be. And for that reason, I'm hesitant to look at a team that, like the Braves, that won the division last year, sort of came out of nowhere, and say that they're going to repeat it again this year. I think, for me, the Phillies were close, and they made the moves this offseason. The Braves were there, but I'm not convinced that that's the real Braves. That could have just been last season. So I need to see another year similar to last from the Braves to say that they're on the same level as the Phillies.
Yeah, definitely a little more open in the National League East, similar to the American League East. National League Central last year was Milwaukee Central, Milwaukee's division all season. Chicago Cubs finally relinquished the title after having control for a few years. But the one team that I didn't mention yet is the St. Louis Cardinals. I think that they are the team to beat in the Central this year. They fired Mike Matheny halfway through the season last year, hired Mike Schilt as their manager, and with him, they did very well, had a 0.594 win percentage. That would have been good for 96 wins had they had that manager the whole season. They made very good moves in the offseason, the biggest being getting Paul Goldschmidt from the Diamondbacks, who, I mean, Paul Goldschmidt still is an excellent first baseman. People don't talk about him as much as they did 3 years ago, but don't be confused. He is now the best first baseman in the National League Central. Yes, Anthony Rizzo, I am looking at you. Goldschmidt is the guy. Step up your game a little bit. But no, I think the Cardinals have good pitchers that came out of nowhere as well. Mike Mikolas and Jack Flaherty. Nobody has considered them to be anything last year, and now they are both top of the rotation for the Cardinals. I think they are a solid team. I just think that they have the formula for success.
I think all three of those teams that you just mentioned are playoff teams. I personally don't know that the Cardinals will win the division. I'm not saying that they can't. I think the Cubs will. The Brewers put a lot together last year, and everything seemed to go the right way for them. And that's what you need sometimes to be successful in the playoffs and to get yourself to the playoffs. Could it happen again for them? Sure. They still have fantastic players on that roster, but I personally like the Cubs a little bit more. I think the Cubs have been the most consistent team in this division in recent years. I think that they still look a lot like the team that won the World Series and that has competed recently. So for that reason, again, with the Brewers, I need to see it again from them before I'm totally on board with them. And for the Cardinals, I just want to see how things play out. I certainly think they're a playoff team. Will they be able to reach the peak that the Cubs can hit? I don't know.
Yeah, the Cubs I look at as a team that hasn't lost anything, but for how much the Brewers and Cardinals have done over the last two seasons, I don't know that they've gained enough sustainability to keep up. Javier Baez, I don't really care for him. He is a good player, one of the best players on the Cubs probably. They did lose Yu Darvish last year, who was, you know, one of their big signings that was supposed to help them. Obviously, they did not have the success that they had been accustomed to, but I just look at it as the Brewers were good last year. Their pitching was what was their downfall, ultimately, in the end. That's why they did not advance the World Series nor win it. But their pitching, they just don't have that big staff ace on them. Like the Cubs, you know, they have Darvish, Lester, Quintana. Great rotation. The Cardinals, they have the guys I mentioned. While not being the big names everybody is accustomed to, they certainly are proven and are capable. And whenever they have to play teams like the Pirates and the Reds, who the Reds will be better this year, they will not be the laughing stock of the Central. But when you have the Pirates and the Reds in your division, those are wins that pretty much all three of those teams can guarantee. So definitely more open in the Central. Last division, National League West. It's pretty much been the Dodgers division this whole last decade. I think it's the Rockies' turn, though. The Dodgers did not retain Manny Machado through free agency, but he didn't really help them as much as I think they would have hoped he would have last year. Obviously, they lost two consecutive World Series, looking to get back to a third and go 0-3, though. Golden Sombrero, they call it. But the Rockies certainly have good players on their team. What they mostly have now is the pitching. They have Herman Marquez. They have Kyle Freeland. They've been lacking pitching for years. Playing at Coors Field, it's hard to have good pitching. Yes, they did lose Adam Ottavino, but I think the starters and their position players will help them enough. They did acquire Daniel Murphy through free agency as well. So I think the Rockies have what it takes to knock off the Dodgers finally.
I'm going to put, for me, the Rockies in the same category as the Brewers and the Braves. I just want to see another season from them before I'm totally ready to jump on their bandwagon.
That's fair.
Not crazy about the Dodgers. If you remember, one of my bold predictions a while ago was that Clayton Kershaw would not return because the Dodgers are past their prime, if you will. Obviously, that did not come true. He is there, but I still think that they're past their prime. I don't think this is a Dodgers team that can compete with those teams in the Central. I don't even know that they can compete with the Phillies. I think they will win the division, but I think, I don't want to say that they're like the Indians of the National League, but they kind of are. I think that they'll win the division and go quietly in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, they have good players on our team. Getting Corey Seager back will help them immensely. Essentially, he replaces Manny Machado, you know, slotting back right into that shortstop spot. Max Muncy was a guy that kind of burst on the scene last summer. Didn't really know where he came from. Hard to see if he'll sustain that, but yeah. And when you look at the rest of that division, Diamondbacks, they got rid of half their team. They're not in contention.
They were playing horrible baseball down the stretch, too, last year.
Yeah, at one point, they were competing for the division, I think, July.
They were in first, and then it totally went downhill. Goldschmidt's gone.
Yeah, it's just been a dumpster fire in Arizona for like the last 7 months. The Padres, yes, they've made moves for the future, but that future is not now, so I don't see them competing.
I agree.
The Giants are a team full of 35-year-olds that are getting paid way too much to play at a nice ballpark and put fans in the seats and give the Dodgers, Rockies some wins. That's all I see the Giants doing. So definitely some competition in the West between the Dodgers and Rockies. Not really much for the other two. The wild cards I have in the National League, I have the Brewers as the top wild card, Dodgers as the second wild card, kind of a National League Championship Series rematch there. Interesting to see what they do.
I'll go Cardinals, then Brewers for my wild cards.
All right, so you got three from the Central.
Yes, I like the National League Central far more than I like either of the other two divisions.
So the ultimate question now is, we have our division winners, we have our wild cards. Who do we have in the World Series? I will start from the National League. I think the St. Louis Cardinals have what it takes. They have the longevity. They have the good balance of veterans and youngsters. I think they will get there. In the American League, I think the Yankees will finally return. They have to return. This season, it's almost like a Tampa Bay type season for them.
Tampa Bay Lightning.
Yeah. If they don't get there this year, I don't know what more they can do to get there. This is the best team they've had on paper probably since they won back with Jeter and A-Rod in 2009. If they can't get to the World Series this year, I don't know what they're going to do. So I'm just going to say they're going to get there. And I will pick the St. Louis Cardinals over the Yankees just because they're get there. Doesn't mean they necessarily win. I think the Cardinals just have that veteran experience, that, you know, longer tenured people on their team. I think they will be able to beat the Yankees.
So I'm going to take the Cubs from the National League. And I think we're kind of on the same page here, just with a different team. But for me, what I've learned from the playoff picture, the playoff format, I should say, in baseball, is that it's all about the draw and where you finish in the regular season. For me, the Cubs have been more consistent over recent years, and so I'm going to say that they're going to be more consistent this year. Being more consistent gives them the division and keeps them out of the wild card game. That wild card game, as entertaining as it is tough for those teams to play in it. And if the Cubs can stay out of it, and that could go for any team in the Central, if they can stay out of it, I think they become the favorites in the National League. For me, that's the Cubs, so I'll take them. I'm totally agree with you on the Yankees in the American League. They have to make something happen this year, or they need to seriously reevaluate where they are. I'm going to take the Yankees over the Cubs in the World Series.
Just for a record, last year I had the Cubs against the Astros. That's why I did not choose to put the Cubs in this year. They kind of let me down a bit. 162 games. So many months. We will be covering it sporadically. Definitely going to hit with the playoff coverage later in the fall when we return from our break. But for now, we are going to take a shorter break before we get into some more NFL action and March Madness preview, because it is about to get crazy. So please stay tuned.
Hey!
Welcome back to Sports Takeover with Matt and Chris. Moving on to the NFL, there are still free agent signings and moves being made, so we're going to hit on some of those. First, just a couple side notes, a couple retirements. Max Unger, center for the New Orleans Saints, has retired. Haloti Ngata, defensive tackle for the Philadelphia Eagles, has retired as well. So obviously those are two guys that will not be making an impact anywhere this season, but two guys whose presence will be missed.
Yeah, Unger was part of the Jimmy Graham trade between the Seahawks and the Saints. I don't know if either team really got what they wanted, but they were both solid players, so sad to see him go. Haloti Ngata, he terrorized the Steelers for years on the Ravens, so I'm not as sad to see him go, but I'm sure fans of him are more sad to see him go. One important trade that did happen occurred between the Tennessee Titans and the Miami Dolphins. The Titans received quarterback Ryan Tannehill, yes, former first-round quarterback of the Dolphins, Ryan Tannehill, and a sixth-round pick in exchange for a fourth-round pick and a seventh-round pick. They have Tannehill now to back up Mariota because I guess they figure Mariota is going to get injured for four more games or something this season. I don't know. Mariota's good when he's not hurt, but the problem is he's hurt. I don't know. Tannehill's the right guy either because it seems like he's hurt every season too. It's a weird trade for both these teams.
I agree. It is kind of an odd trade, and it's the same thing that we talked about with trades before, the return is ridiculous. You're looking at a seventh rounder for Miami this year, and that's all that they get out of it, and then the fourth round is next year, which if you're Miami, you're in a rebuilding mode. I don't know that a fourth and a seventh helps you. They did sign a quarterback to take his place. It's Ryan Fitzpatrick. Fitzpatrick, I think, is a very good short-term solution for Miami. I assume that they'll use the draft to address the long-term. Ideally, if you're Miami, you draft a young quarterback, let them sit behind Fitzpatrick for the 2 years that his contract is for, and then that guy takes over a couple years from now as you're on the upswing. I think losing Tannehill is kind of disappointing to Dolphins fans. I think Fitzpatrick is a good fit for now, not obviously in the long term, but for now. It'll be an interesting season for the Dolphins, and it'll be interesting to see how Tannehill fits in Tennessee.
Yeah, it's just weird because Tannehill was not a bad quarterback.
They
put average teams around him, never the best. I mean, they traded away the good players. They had Jay Ajayi and Jarvis Landry. They've now let Cam Wake walk in the offseason, great defender. I mean, they're just a team that can't figure out what they want to do with themselves. They're like, do we want to go 6-10 or 10-6 this year or somewhere in the middle? Well, that's what they've been the last 10 seasons, and I don't see them really changing that much. Fitzpatrick, now all of us in elementary school learned about the water cycle. You know, it rains, the water moves through the ground, and then it evaporates back up. Well, there's the Ryan Fitzpatrick cycle. He rides the bench for a time period, right? Then the starting quarterback, he gets hurt or doesn't play well, so Fitzpatrick goes in, does average. Then he has the great period where he is the talk of the league. And then he goes back into hiding on the bench when he starts to suck again. This will be his eighth team in the league. That's 25% of the National Football League he will have thrown the passes for. This is his third team in the AFC East, everyone besides the Patriots that he will have started for. Ryan Fitzpatrick is not the Fitzmagic that people thought he was at the beginning of the season. He is a average quarterback that is not better than Tannehill, and I don't know. Miami is just not something that I can figure out.
It's a very interesting way of putting that. Moving on to another team that made a couple of moves, the Pittsburgh Steelers added two players, Dante Moncrief, wide receiver, on a two-year contract. Also added Mark Barron on a two-year contract on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, nothing that's going to break the bank or anything. Barron fills in that inside linebacker very well. Moncrief doesn't replace Antonio Brown, but he is at least a deep threat down the field, kind of takes some of the pressure off Juju. So, they're solid, not earth-shattering, but they're solid. Some bigger moves, though, occurred. Linebackers Clay Matthews, two-year deal with the Rams. He returns back to the Coliseum where he played his college ball for USC, has a home about 10 minutes away from the stadium. Clearly, this guy is a California guy. If you've seen his blonde hair, he fits in very well. He will be a great addition for the Rams, seeing how they lost Mark Barron. Another California linebacker, I hate him. Everyone hates him in Pittsburgh, Vontez Burfict. The burden for many a Steeler fan, injured Le'Veon Bell many times, leveled Antonio Brown, gave him a concussion. Well, now he can do that to him in practice. They will be sharing the Raiders sideline together. He signed a one-year deal with Oakland. Thoughts on either of those two?
So Vontez Burfict is a very odd fit, I think, in Oakland because of Antonio Brown. That's a very interesting dynamic that they're going to have to deal with there.
And John Gruden, too.
I don't think he's worth $5 million. When he plays smart, he's a fantastic linebacker. But when he plays stupid, he's dirty. And just a guy that doesn't really belong in the league. So one-year deal, you're not taking a big gamble on him, but sometimes guys like that just aren't worth the trouble. Clay Matthews, on the other hand, I like a lot. Obviously a very good fit out in Los Angeles, and I'm sure that that's the reason that he went out that direction. I think that's going to leave a gap for the Packers, but I think it fills one very nicely for the Rams, both on the field and in terms of leadership, and I think that's where he'll be missed the most in Green Bay.
Well, the Packers did have three linebacker free agent signings, so I guess they just want to move on from Matthews. Obviously, he is still an excellent linebacker, but you know, sometimes you just need to, okay, you know, need a new fit, whatever. Some more minor ones, two receivers. Randall Cobb signed a one-year deal with Dallas. He also left Green Bay. A good slot receiver, not really that much more. Injuries have kind of plagued him a little bit. A bigger receiver, actually, Golden Tate. He is not Odell Beckham Jr., but for the Giants' considerations, he will do his best to replace them. He signed a four-year deal with the Giants. He is a very good receiver. He had about 90 receptions or so in each of the last 5 years. Definitely a solid guy. Not quite the deep threat that OBJ was, not the speed, but he is very solid all around. Thoughts on either of them too?
I like them both. I think they're both solid additions for their team. For the Giants, it gives you a weapon to replace Odell Beckham Jr., who, for the record, I don't think is quite as good as people make him out to be. So Golden Tate can fill that hole a little bit better than I think most people would give him credit for. Randall Cobb to Dallas. Why not add another weapon there on that offense? They've already got some. I think Randall Cobb is a guy who has shown that he can shine when he's healthy. Obviously has struggled to stay healthy, but if he can, I think he'll have a good season in Dallas.
Someone that will not be having a good season will be Blake Bortles. He was bad with Jacksonville. Never once was it the answer, at least in my opinion. I guess Jacksonville fans were hoping for years. Well, now he will be the clipboard holder for Jared Goff on the Rams sideline. He signed a one-year deal as the backup, obviously. Hopefully for Rams fans' sake, he never sees a light of day unless he's taking a knee or something. But, man, Blake Bortles, what a guy.
Yeah, interesting contract there. A couple other ones. Tyler Eifert will stay in Cincinnati on a one-year deal. Dominique Rogers-Cromartie is off to the Washington Redskins. And right tackle Eric Flowers is also headed to the Washington Redskins. So a couple of guys headed to Washington that have had some success in their career. Whether they will or not in Washington remains to be seen. But some more minor moves there. And one more backup quarterback, A.J. McCarron, to the Houston Texans on a one-year deal to be the backup.
Yeah, good for them. Deshaun Watson has had injury history. I like McCarron. Very good backup. Seems like the Redskins are just getting all the Giants scraps. They got Eric Flowers, who was cut by the Giants, signed Landon Collins. So guess they'll be looking for some revenge. And one more fun signing, not the NFL, the AAF, Alliance of American Football. He's back, ladies and gentlemen. Johnny Football signed a deal with Memphis to be the quarterback for their team. It's interesting. It'll put fans in the seats, put eyeballs on the TV. I don't know what he's going to do. I guess his plans get back in the NFL, but it's at least another story headline for people like us to talk about.
I think it's fantastic. People will tune in to watch him. People will come to the stadium to watch him. And for Memphis, they don't have a quarterback anyway, so you might as well take a chance on him. I think it's good.
Ideally, this is the end of the NFL free agency. I'm sure more people will roll in the coming weeks, but this is the bulk of it. Thankfully, they get it all done in 2 weeks as opposed to Major League Baseball. Moving ahead, something that will get done in about 4 weeks, over the course of 4 weeks, starts this Thursday. Well, it's already started, but mainly starts this Thursday. It's March Madness, baby, and we have the preview for you right here. So in March Madness is here, 68 teams. I'm going to break it down by conference. There are 8 in the Big Ten, 7 in the ACC, 7 in the SEC, 6 in the Big 12, 4 in the Big East, and the American Athletic Conference, and 3 in the Pac-12. So interesting to see the Big Ten having 8 when 3 of the 4 number one seeds come out of the ACC. We have Duke, Virginia, and North Carolina all representing the ACC as one seeds. And Gonzaga throws themselves in there because why not? They're excellent. The 2 seeds got some out of the Big Ten. We have 2 Big Ten and 2 SEC. Tennessee and Kentucky represent the SEC, and Michigan State and Michigan represent the Big Ten. Thoughts on any of these kind of combinations, Matt?
I think the conference stats are interesting. That's not something that I looked for. Kind of makes it interesting to look at that compared to where teams are ranked and how the committee took the strength of the conference into consideration. Interesting there. You talked about some games have gotten underway. The first 4 in to get our field from 68 to 64 last night. Number 16, Fairleigh Dickinson, beat 16, Prairie View.
Way to represent the NEC, guys.
That's right. And number 11, Belmont, beat number 11, Temple, to get into the round of 64 there. So a couple more taking place tonight. And then, as you mentioned, we get into the thick of it on Thursday.
Going back to last year's Final Four, the Final Four represented last year are Michigan, Kansas, Villanova, and Loyola. Michigan is a 2 seed, Kansas is a 4, Villanova, the reigning champions, are a 6, and Loyola did not qualify this year. So basketball, like, it's very inconsistent. Some teams are very good one season, the next season they only make the tournament. Interesting there, Gardner Webb and Abilene Christian. first appearances for them. I'm sure it'll be one and done, but hey, congrats to those schools for getting in. Who are some sleeper teams that you may have looked at, Matt? I have a few. I'm not sure if you do, though.
So I have one team that I, in my bracket, is a big upset. I have them going two rounds. That's number 12, Liberty. I have them knocking off number 5, Mississippi State, and number 4, Virginia Tech. Something about 12 seeds in this tournament, every year it never fails. A 12 seems to find a way to win, so every year I pick a 12 to win. This year I happen to pick Liberty to go two rounds. One thing I will say is that in March Madness, I don't think you can look too deep into anything that happened in the regular season, any particular matchup. It's madness for a reason. For me, I don't feel like I need a good reason to back up a number 12. It could just happen because that's what goes down in March, and Liberty is the team that I think can turn some heads this year.
Patrick Henry said, give me Liberty or give me death. It sounds like Matt is saying the same thing.
Wow, that's a good one. Good one, Chris. He can't keep it together now, so I guess I'll just keep going here. One matchup that I'm really looking forward to as the tournament gets underway is this first round matchup, number 5 Marquette and number 12 Murray State. Once again, these 5-12 matchups have proven to be unpredictable, and I like number 12 Murray State. Both of these teams have had decent seasons. Murray State 29-4. Of course, the strength of competition in the regular season doesn't necessarily doesn't stack up, I guess, between different teams. 29-4 as a 12 seed is obviously not the same as 29-4 for a 2 seed, but it'll be interesting to see how it goes for them in the tournament. Chris, are you ready over there?
Yeah, Murray State is a team I like a lot. I have them knocking off Marquette, too. Jay Morant, he is the best player that Murray State has probably had in their whole program history. He is a projected top 5 pick in the NBA draft this year, so he will be able to get the job done. It's just whether or not they can get it done over Marquette, which is a team I did like throughout the season. They were projected to be a 3 seed. Unfortunately, they lost pretty much all of their last games to end the season, ended up falling down to a 5. But yeah, Murray State's definitely a team I like. Some other ones I want to look out for. 2 31-3 teams that do not receive equal treatment. Buffalo is 31-3, won their conference. They are a 6 seed. Houston is 31-3. They lost their conference. They're a 3 seed. I just don't. Obviously, they have different strengths of schedules. Yes, Houston plays in the AAC. It's a stronger conference than the MAC, don't get me wrong. But for them to have the identical records, one to win the conference, it's like the committee doesn't even look at conference champions. Same thing can apply for Michigan and Michigan State. Michigan State was able to knock off Michigan in the conference title game for the third time this season. And what's their reward? They get placed in the same region that Duke is in. I don't consider that to be a reward. I consider that to be punishment because Duke is by far the favorite to win. It's just that they don't look at them. Tennessee is another one. They got crushed by Auburn by 20 points in their conference title game. So they get put at a 2 seed, too. It's baffling to me. It's like these committees don't look at conference championships as anything more than ways to end the season. It's more ways to count people out as opposed to helping count people in.
Yeah, I think, too, when you look at the fact that the bracket gets released hours after the final games are played, obviously, they have some sense of where they want to put these teams, right, regardless of their performance. And it is the overall body of work as opposed to just the conference finals. So
yeah, one more. Murray State was able to knock off Belmont in their conference title game. So Belmont gets the 11 seed and Murray State gets the 12, and Murray State has the better record.
And Belmont had to play their way into the round of 64. They weren't even in necessarily.
Yeah, I just don't get it. It's just very odd the way they decide to choose where, what regions they go into, what regions they don't. Like, Virginia and Tennessee are the 1 and 2 in the same region. Well, Virginia couldn't even win a game last year, and Tennessee got crushed in their title game by 20 points. I just don't think there's a good balance between good and bad in each region. It's interesting to see how they go. Interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, time will tell whether or not teams are put where they're supposed to be put, but it is March Madness, and we'll see what happens. Anything can happen, and there have been some teams over the history of the tournament that have shown just that, that anything can happen. And so this week we decided to incorporate another segment of Top Takeover, where we look at the top 5 March Madness upsets of all time. Chris, why don't you lead us off?
I will start in 2016. It is with the number 10. They were ranked 10th in the bracket, Syracuse Orange. They ended up making it to the Final Four, the first 10 seed to ever make a Final Four. They knocked off number 7 Dayton, maybe got some help by playing number 15 Middle Tennessee State. Curse you, Michigan State. I picked you that year. Never again. Number 11 Gonzaga, also some help there. Number 1 Virginia, and they end up losing to number 1 UNC in the Final Four. So first 10 seed, got to include them. Very impressive from Syracuse that year.
That's a very good one, and I'm going to start in the same year in the same region with Middle Tennessee. They did not go very deep, but they had a very impressive win over number 2 Michigan State. The score was 90-81, so not a dominating win by any stretch of the imagination, but a solid margin of victory for a number 15 over a number 2. You mentioned that they would eventually lose to number 10 Syracuse, but Michigan State was one of the top teams in the country all season. They were ranked number 1 at one point. They were a very strong number 2, and according to one website I found in ESPN brackets that year, 22.3% of the brackets had Michigan State winning the entire tournament. So everybody was very high on Michigan State. The committee was, fans were, and somehow out of nowhere, number 15 Middle Tennessee comes along and knocks them out. Of course, one game not quite as impressive as some long runs, but it was a heck of a performance by Middle Tennessee.
Yeah, they definitely shattered my hopes and dreams that year for sure. I will take it back 10 years for my number 4 going to 2006. It is with the number 11, they are ranked 11, George Mason. They were able to knock off number 6, Michigan State. Man, they just seem to take everybody's fun. Number 3, North Carolina. Number 7, Wichita State. Number 1, UConn, before losing in the Final Four to number 3, Florida. George Mason, first 11 seed to ever make the Final Four, came out of nowhere. They have now since fallen back into the abyss of nothingness. But hey, 2006, they had a great run. Like I said, first 11 seed to ever make the Final Four. That is tied for the highest seed ever to make a Final Four with a few other teams, Loyola, VCU, but still, congrats to them on being the first to do it.
Speaking of an 11 seed to get to the Final
Perfect
Four.
Perfect segue for you.
Isn't it, though? My number 4 will be VCU from 2011. They had to play their way into the tournament in one of those first 4, and they knocked off USC to get to the round of 64. They then beat Georgetown, who was ranked 6th that year. Followed that up by knocking out a 3 seed in Purdue, number 10 Florida State, and number 1 Kansas before they eventually lost to Butler in the Final Four. One of very few, as you mentioned, 11 seeds to get that far. Not quite as impressive as George Mason, I will say, but I think even still, the path that they took to get to the Final Four was impressive. Obviously, they knocked off a 1 seed by 10 points, too. Kansas was 71-61.
That's impressive.
Very good win, very good path, very impressive to see an 11 seed get there.
I like me some Shaka Smart, VCU's coach. He's done good things for them. Georgetown, they're a team that we'll be talking about later. They seem to be on list everywhere, too. My number 3 team will be just last year. You can't have a list like this and not include them. Number 16, UMBC. They were the first number 16 to ever win a game in March Madness. They beat number 1 overall in the entire bracket, Virginia. So essentially it was the worst team in the whole bracket playing the best team. And Virginia just not show up. It was a spanking too. It wasn't really even that close. They did go on to lose to number 9 Kansas State in the next round. But still, being the first and only, as of right now, 16 seed to win, very impressive. I just didn't see the longevity there. That's why I didn't include them higher than 3. But hey, they have to make the list, so I'm putting them at 3.
Number 3 for me is someone you already mentioned, number 11, George Mason. And that's why I said I thought George Mason was slightly more impressive, because that was my thought process earlier, putting them one spot above VCU. As you mentioned, Michigan State, UNC, Wichita State, UConn, all in the line of fire for George Mason back in 2006. Eventually lost to number 3 Florida, as you said. I'm not going to harp on it too much because you talked about them and I kind of talked about VCU. It's the same thing. It's a number 11 going the whole way to the Final Four. Very impressive. George Mason was one spot higher for me just because I thought their road to the Final Four was slightly more impressive. But anytime you can go from an 11 seed all the way to the last 4 teams standing, very impressive. So that's my number 3.
Yeah, watch out. Those 11s and 12s are treacherous. My number 2 goes back to 2013. It is with another 15 seed, not Middle Tennessee State, Florida Gulf Coast University. They were able to beat, number 2 Georgetown at the time. They just have a tendency to lose. And they also beat number 7 San Diego State. They are the only 15 seed to have won 2 games in the tournament before, once you know it, they lost to number 3 ranked Florida. So it seems like Florida is a good team when they're ranked 3. They knocked off George Mason and Florida Gulf Coast, but hey, they're 3 for a reason. Congrats to Florida Gulf Coast, though. They've done the most a 15 seed has ever done, and they certainly had some impressive dunks in that game. I remember watching it. Very exciting, so they're number 2 on my list.
Yeah, well, Michigan State allows no-name teams to beat them year in and year out for our entertainment. Florida likes to crush dreams and send the Cinderella teams home, so that's interesting. My number 2 is the exact same team, that number 15 Florida Gulf Coast team in 2013.
I like it.
For all the reasons that you mentioned, it's the first 15 seed to reach the Sweet 16. Very impressive showing, wins again to get there. 10 points over both of those 2 opponents, a 2 seed and a 7 seed, and they battled Florida. It was a close game. Very good effort there by a number 15. That's my number 2, same as yours.
My number one, we're taking it way, way back to the 80s. I was, you know, alive then. It is 1985. It is number 8 ranked Villanova. Well, how are you going to put number 8 in the list? They should beat good teams. Well, this is the only number 8 seed to have ever won the entirety of March Madness. That's the highest a seed has ever been to win as well. On their way to the title, they knocked off number 9 Dayton, number 1 Michigan, number 5 Maryland, number 2 UNC, number 2 Memphis State, number 1 Georgetown. Georgetown, man, they just, everyone gets them. But yes, only number
Michigan State.
Only number 8 seed to ever win the title, highest ranked team to ever win the title. And it was Villanova's only title for about 30 years till they have won now 2 in the last 3 years, but very impressive to see a number 8 team be able to knock off all those teams. 2 number 2s, 2 number 1s along the way. Very impressive. They are number 1 on my list for that reason.
That is very impressive, and it was one that I strongly considered putting on my list, but it's not going to be my number one. My number one is going to be someone that you have already talked about, and it was number 16, UMBC from last season. And yes, they did only win one as opposed to Villanova going the whole way, but they were the first 16 seed ever to win a game in March Madness, on the men's side anyway. And you talked about how good Virginia was throughout the season, the number one overall in the tournament, and they lost by 20 points. It was 74 to 54. So it's one thing if you're a 16 seed and you pull it out in overtime. That's an impressive win, very well done. But for you to knock out the top team in the tournament by 20 points is incredible. And it was only their second ever appearance in the NCAA tournament. 08 was their other appearance, so 10 years separating the only two times that they've ever been there, and they managed to knock off the top team. They did lose. They fell flat in the round of 32, but hey, when you get in as a 16 seed, your hopes are not that high, and the fact that they are able to make this happen, to me, is just incredible, and it's something that I don't think we're going to see for a long time again.
No, I definitely agree. Good upsets here. March Madness is all about the upsets. Will we see some this weekend? Sure. Will they shatter some brackets? Absolutely. That's the fun of March Madness. That was Top Takeover. Now to wrap up the show, we have quick picks. We are going to start in the NHL. Metropolitan Division rivalry. Islanders going to the Flyers. I went with the Flyers in this one. The Islanders looked horrible in their game against the Bruins the other night. They got shot out 5-0, had 13 total shots. The Flyers have had some impressive victories over the Penguins in the recent weeks. I think the Flyers don't have any chance to make the playoffs, but in their minds, they are still vying for a playoff spot, so I'm going to go with the Flyers here.
So I'm going to take the Islanders, and there's really only one reason. They're 0-2 against Philadelphia this month. I don't think they're going to go 0-3. They've been very average this month, and you talked about them not looking good the other night, but I just don't think they're going to lose 3 in the matter of, 20 days to the Flyers, so I'll take the New York Islanders. Blackhawks and Avalanche, this is a little different than anything we've done before. They have a home-and-home. They play, I believe, Saturday and Sunday, one in each building. So we're going to call either a sweep for one way or the other or a split. I'm going to go with a split simply because I don't think either of these teams have shown enough to pull away from one another. I think they're going to be neck and neck as we get to the end of the regular season, and I don't think they're going to gain any ground one way or the other. I think they'll split this weekend.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you on that on a split. I imagine both teams will use two different goalies, but I can't even name the backup goalies for each of those two teams because they are very average. Like I said, like you said, neither team really has shined. They are both not in a playoff spot right now, just a few points behind Arizona. One of these two teams needs a sweep, but the fact is that they both need a sweep means that they're probably going to end up splitting, though, so I will agree with you on the split. Very important matchup for the wild card in the Eastern Conference. Montreal travels to Carolina. Carolina had a great comeback victory against the Penguins last night. Montreal, they've not looked great of recently. Yes, Carey Price has gotten the record, but in general, they have not been as strong as they've been before. This is a game that Montreal must win. I think they're going to win it. Carolina is strong, but you know Montreal wants this game more. They need it more. I'm going to go with the Canadiens.
I'm going to go with the Hurricanes. They're 6-2-1 in the month of March. The Canadiens are a team that have held on to a playoff spot for almost the entire season but have fallen out. I think that they are going to stay out, and when these big points are up for grabs in the wild card race, I'm going to go with the Hurricanes. On to the NBA, Celtics at 76ers in a matchup that I'm sure we've talked plenty about already, but nevertheless, it's huge as we move into the NBA playoffs. I'm going to go with the 76ers. For a similar reason that I picked the Islanders earlier, the Celtics are going for a season sweep of the 76ers. I don't think they're going to be able to do that. The Sixers are on a 5-game win streak. I'll take Philadelphia.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. Philadelphia can't lose to Boston now. This is dire times. They need to lock up a higher position in the playoffs. It's very competitive in the East. I think the Sixers will be able to take this one against the Celtics. Moving into the West, we have the Spurs, who have surprised some this year, traveling to Houston, which has also surprised some given how both these teams were structured going into the year. Houston is currently near the top of the West, not quite there. I think a win over the Spurs will help get them further, maybe get them a 2 seed even. So I'm going to go with the Rockets in this one.
I'm going to take the Rockets, too. They've won 12 of 13. The Spurs have won 9 in a row. Two crazy hot teams. I'm going to go with
nine
the Rockets.
Row.
Right. Looking at March Madness, a couple games, a couple interesting games. Number 8, Utah State against number 9, Washington. I'm going to take Utah State. This game could go either way in an 8-9 battle. Washington, though, is 1-7 against top 50 teams as ranked by the committee. For that reason, I'm going to go with Utah State.
I don't think that I ever pick 8 and 9s correctly, so I will probably not get it right here, but I will go with the 9th-ranked Washington Huskies. I don't have any reason to pick them other than the fact that's where Isaiah Thomas played about 5 years ago, and that's the only reason I remember them for being good, so I'm going to go with the Huskies. 7-10 matchup. They're just about as hard as the 8-9s. Well, we have number 7, Wofford, which is a team that probably should have been ranked higher than 7th, against number 10, Seton Hall, which is a team that knocked off Villanova in their conference tournament. For that reason, I will go with the Seton Hall Pirates. I think they have what it takes. I think Wofford might be a flash in the pan.
I'm going to go with Wofford. They're 29-4 on the season. Very good record. They've got more points per game than Seton Hall. Also better defense. I think that could come in play here, so I'm going to take Wofford. That is it for us. We appreciate everyone tuning in. We will be back at the same time next week. Matt and Chris on Sports Takeover signing off. Have a great night, everyone.